In the heart of Canada's great outdoors, where fishing is more than just a pastime, it's a way of life. There's a brewing company that strives to represent the true essence of Canadiana.
Introducing the Ugly Pike Brewing Company, born from a passion for celebrating the moments that define us as Canadians.
Founded by Christopher Walter and Frank Ungaro in 2022, Ugly Pike Brewing Company is more than just a brewery. It's a tribute to the timeless tradition of fishing passed down from generation to generation.
Crafting a crisp and easy drinking beer, they honor the angler's commitment to the environment with a zero waste philosophy.
Just as campers, cottagers, and anglers care for the places they cherish, Ugly Pike Brewing Company makes every brew with sustainability and environmental stewardship in mind.
Head to uglypikebrewing.com today to order online or use our interactive retail location map.
How's the grind?
Good
job, buddy.
The Hunt for Answers, the Ugly Pike Podcast.
Welcome back to the Ugly Pike Podcast on the Outdoor Journal Radio Network. This episode is brought to you by Canada's only specialized pike and muskie shop, Izoco. Head over to izocofishing.com and check out all the amazing hand-picked, top-quality gear they have to offer. Again, that's izocofishing.com. Today in the second part, we're going to dive deeper into fall patterns across the Great Lake water system and also touch on some noteworthy stab wounds from our guests. So, I mean, we're going to just point to you, Alex. Tell us, how would you describe the shift in muskie behavior at this time of year, and how does that affect your patterning or targeting, and what are some of your key tactics in terms of locating the fish? Because I know you're very, you have a strategy, you have these tactics of figuring out the pattern. So is that like you come into this these conditions with a predetermined set of things you're going to follow, or you're adapting on the site based on obviously the current conditions? But let us know your mindset in terms of how you're understanding the movement of fish from, you know, the summer to the early fall to now this time of year.
And let's keep in mind that we're probably going to do a casting component to this trip. And that's something we've never really done this time of year, but that's definitely something others do. I know John Anderson and his crew, those guys are casting till, you know.
Lazarus does also.
Yeah, Lazarus as well. So, I mean, I know we're not sitting in casting into 8-foot weed beds right now this time of year looking for muskie, unless we will be. Okay, but trolling wise, we're definitely going deeper, right?
Yeah, there's I wish I could tell you, I'm not on the water enough to tell you the exact temperature, but at some point the temperature drops below 50. The weeds are still good, but not as good as they were all summer long. And the fish move deep. Now, based on what we saw yesterday, the fish moving deep, I mean over 15 feet or whatever. Like you said, you're not casting shallow weeds or shallow flats. When the fish move deep, it kind of looks like it corresponds with the minnows showing up deep. So in the summer, it's rare that you see schools of minnows just outside the weed line as the day goes on. But in the fall, it becomes more typical that you see bait fish. And I wish I could tell you which bait fish it is, right? It could be perch, could be walleye, could be both. It could be shiners, and it could be shiners being chased by perch, being chased by walleye.
That's what I was trying to think about last night, emerald shiners.
Shiners.
Because I know on Erie, I was fishing with Hans the other day, and he was saying that, what was the other fish now? The
Shad?
Shad.
Yeah, Shad chasing Shad. Shiners, okay.
Yeah.
And I know nothing about Erie, and learning about Erie and the other Great Lakes is very interesting to me just because of that, right?
It was such an interesting thing to observe. I don't want to talk about it too much because Hans is going to come on the show and we're going to break it down, but it's really interesting. And it looked to me like the bait fish here was a lot bigger. Like we didn't see too many schools of small. We saw some.
Clouds,
We saw a lot of what looked like to me to be walleye and perch.
But just
On your weed point there, are you finding that muskie are still holding in these kind of dying or dead weed patches? Do you find that
they're not dead yet? They're green still.
They're still green?
Yeah. They're green, but there's been a solid die off and the floaters from October are gone, if that makes sense. And that'll change per water system. Obviously, if you're up on Eagle Lake, it's a different world, right? Because it's dead cold right now up there. So I couldn't tell you how it works up there, but here
we had such a warm October in southern Ontario,
which might be affecting these green weeds right now. So that's why we're going to try casting, because I've been told that the weeds are still good now. So it wouldn't be a waste of time. But also,
would that be the case if this was a typical weather pattern in late November?
I think it still would be. 10? It still would be, because I've heard of guys casting into December in very shallow water with giant rubber, right? It's not, John Anderson said it, some fish live shallow all year long.
Yeah.
Some fish travel hundreds of kilometers. So the trick is find where those shallow fish are staying shallow. The trick is cut off where those fish are traveling hundreds of kilometers a summer, and then find those weed lines you've had experience with in the past, and you'll get bites where the bait is, which is what happens. We get bites under the bait or through the bait.
So today, are we going to be doing things we do in the summer, like locations and tactics?
Yes, but like, different baits.
I'm thinking of weed lines that we do, you know, those weed lines that we do in the summer when we come here, you know the spots where they do the same thing.
But different.
Is that your plan for today, or are we going to do something different?
So
for casting.
I don't even know if we will cast today, but if we would have casted today, we would have tried that, but we would have tried it different baits, just giant rubber.
Okay.
Giant rubber. Giant rubber tubes and a barbarian prototype that I will not mention.
That's not rubber.
No.
You're talking about that?
No, I'm talking about something else. You'll see.
I know.
Okay. I'm getting tired of it too.
But Alex, like that puzzle. So when you first get on the water, what are you looking at right away? Let's say you go to the water temperature. Let's say you go to your key spots that have produced over the years. Let's say you go to trying to find the bait fish. What is the pattern that you start your day off with in terms of how you start evaluating where you might locate these fish?
In a completely new area or in an area I'm familiar with?
Let's say both. Like, what if something you're familiar with, would you stick to your typical breakdown of the kind of conditions, or would you adapt based on changing water temperatures, location? And then from something new that you haven't been to before, how would you approach that?
So if I'm using spots I'm familiar with, I will stick to patterns I have established in the past. If the patterns are doing well that day, I'll get 3 bites. If the patterns are doing terribly that day, I'll get no bites or 1 bite. And those patterns are trolling outside the weed line, targeting those deep fish that are following the school of bait. So the bait will change spots in the bigger area that I'm trolling. The bait will either be in the weeds during the day or down deep during the day. And then as night falls, the bait will be, from 16 to 25. So I'm basically always doing the same thing. I'm always just beating on those spots that I have confidence in. I'm making sure my baits are clean when I'm running them through the baits. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
you're kind of going over the same spots a few times in one day, and you want to make sure your baits are clean and everything. Your baits are at the right depth, and everything's great when you're going through the spot on the spot. And if I'm in a totally new area, I'll be looking for that bait along weed lines. But the way I start is by looking for current breaks. So bays are current breaks, or some areas are closed off from weed humps and stuff like that. So spots where there's a current break.
So let me ask you.
Also, yeah. Connections to like the main river, like tributaries or stuff like connections.
Ultimately, they all have a connection. Yeah.
But we have our spots on this location. Now that we have what looks like to be, I don't want to say a significant wind, but the way the wind's blowing, it's not strong, but it's a factor today, right? So is that going to change? Are we going to target different shorelines? Are we going to be targeting shorelines that are exposed to this wind, or are we going to just be fishing our proven patterns? Are we going to deviate?
We can't.
Because are we going to assume that the bait fish are going to be swept onto these certain shores? So is our tactic going to be to cast in those spots and then troll in our normal lanes, or how do we pivot here, or do we?
We'll be trolling our normal lanes, but I'll expect the bait to be in the windblown part of the trolling pattern. Okay.
So in the event that a fish is transitory or just hanging out in those lanes, or you know, not where the current is, we might contact a fish because we have in the past, still might be there.
Yeah. Okay. It's where they like to sit at this time of year.
Okay.
Likely because of the food, likely, right? And because it's a relaxing spot where the current's not beating on them relentlessly. In the summer, there's spots that are in the current, just a hump that comes out of the river, and it's full of weeds, and the fish just sit there like crazy. But they're not there at this time of year. They're gone. They're closer to shore. They're not in the middle of the river. They're not in current. They're tucked away, I guess, expecting for winter to come, just relaxing in a tucked away spot for the winter.
Okay, cool.
Chris, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, I always find that, I mean, and I think a lot of anglers have this question. It's like, you know, not everybody, the majority of us are not able to just hop on the water and know what to do. And we look to people like yourself and other, you know, great experienced anglers to help us understand how to figure out that pattern. And, you know, considering the weather conditions at a time of year like now, like you have to factor in a lot of stuff to, first of all, safety is the most important, but finding the fish is obviously the key in catching the fish. So what is the kind of the key indicators that lead you to finding those fish? And that's why I was asking you, is you go for, try to find the bait first. You go right to the spot first. Do you look at the water temperature and say, well, now that I know the temperature is here, I'm going to go deeper automatically? Or, you know, these are the kind of things that we're always trying to figure out and to lead to success. So that's kind of what I was trying to get your perspective on it. Obviously, there's no right answer. As you mentioned, some people just stay in the shallows and cast in the weeds like John Anderson, and others are going 16 to 20, or using, you know, crankbaits the whole time, and they're successful. But just wanted to get your perspective on that.
Chris, I think what Alex said in the notes, patterns but flexibility really is the key.
Yeah.
You talk about baits and you know, targeting those bait schools, and all of us anglers do that. But I can tell you that on Alex's best patterns, your late winter pattern that we started fishing when we met, and this pattern here, we know when the bait are coming in.
And
like we know, they come in like clockwork.
I want to add something real specific though. Like, so I'll be looking for a place where I think the muskie will be happy to sit all winter. And when the water hits below 50, I'll be trolling deeper. I won't be trolling blades in 6 feet of water, right? Deeper means 15 to 25. But Chris, there's something real, there's a real good important detail here. You know how many hundreds of hours I have spent trolling different spots between 15 and 25 feet of water, switching out different baits until in 15 feet, that bait gets bitten three times if you drive for 8 hours. Like it took years. So you can't expect to go somewhere and just start banging them. And honest to God, you should be putting three good days in every spot before you kind of like give up on it. And last year's kind of proof of that, right? Because we fished in December last year before the season closed, and we got nothing.
Yeah.
No bites, no rips, nothing. Fishing patterns that Frank and I had impressed John Anderson with. Like, you know what I mean? So these patterns.
Why did that happen?
Were
we too late?
I think the fish don't act the same to the day every year, and that might be based on really cold Octobers or really warm Octobers. So some patterns exist for weeks, and we might have been there 2 days too late or 2 days too early.
Okay.
And the other thing is, you know, people talk about the moon. I'm sorry to tell you, but if the waves are 4 feet high, the moon doesn't fucking matter, right? And so the weather, some simple, weird, unexplainable weather pattern might have just shut those fish off for 3-4 days, or maybe those fish were eating at 3 a.m. or 2 a.m. that week,
mm-hmm.
right? And I'm sorry, but I'm not going to fish at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Some guys do. Some guys will fish. But the one of the really important factors, and maybe the best advice I've got to tell people is, if you've got water next to your house, if you can be on the water within 15 minutes, take the time to learn that water, because you will find a pattern and you will benefit from it greatly. And you might make your friends benefit from it too, like those patterns I have on the Ottawa at late fall, right? Like those patterns just put out. But there's some luck involved. Sometimes it takes 2 hours to figure out the fish are biting using that pattern. And that's one thing LiveScope does.
Yeah.
LiveScope allows you to see the fish chasing your jigging bait instantly. And now it's not a question of whether or not the fish is there. It's a question of what the fish will eat and when.
Right.
So you're shortening that learning
curve.
Thank
God you just sold your LiveScope.
Immensely. Yeah, I sold my LiveScope.
Isn't that cutting edge? Like what was your decision? What was your logic in that? It was a defective?
What I learned this year is I need to be a lot more flexible than I was. So it took me years of pain and suffering to learn my patterns. And now I kind of refuse to not fish my patterns. Mm. And then I have years where things are different and I need to not fish my patterns to catch fish. So last year I was staring at my live scope and we lost 6 and got skunked. So I kind of hated my live scope. I got fooled by coincidence and I thought the live scope is the reason I'm not catching fish. I'm looking at my bait on my live scope instead of running my bait as I was last year, right? So I sold my live scope. So the other thing is I needed money. I sold the live scope this winter and I intend on buying another one. The live scope didn't do the job to jig Lakers that I wanted it to do.
Right.
Live scope didn't work past 40 feet. I need the new live scope that works down 80 feet because I want to be able to jig Lakers with Wes. I want the kids to be able to look at the screen and play video games with fish. That's one of the reasons I sold it too. But,
Chris, I'm really hoping we could do a round table debate. We've been talking about doing an episode where we talk about. Sorry, Chris?
No, for years we've been talking about this roundtable, and now it sounds like we're going to talk about that topic is a perfect polarizing topic for you. Just get two or three people pro and against. It's kind of like what's happening in the world right now. Just have vicious arguments.
I think to the community that's listening, like we would like to get a person on either side of the argument that's, you know, respected in the industry and someone that everybody knows puts time on the water. And you know what, if you're interested in participating in a civil and friendly debate, like obviously we want to be respectful, but I think it would be great to have a discussion with someone firmly on the pro side and someone firmly on the nay side of the live scope debate, just to get it out there. So if anybody wants to participate, reach out to us on social media. You'll be talking to me and we'll set something up for the new year for that. And let's bang it out, Chris. I think we have to.
I think everybody's right. It's the weirdest debate.
You know what?
It's like they're a pain in the ass, but they're magical.
You're 100% right. I think everybody's right. That's right.
I'll tell you one thing that's terrible, though. You can't let somebody pay for a tournament entry and then tell him he can't use his live scope after he paid for his entry.
I think the use of live scope has to be tied to a rule set, because you can't tell someone not to do something that's legal, right?
I mean, agree.
That's just stupid. It's just, you can be as philosophical as you want, but that's just not real world expectation. So ultimately, I think it has to be tied to a rule set, and that's up to a guy like Dave Gray, you know, or a guy like Tony Tickle or anybody else who's running a tournament that wants to, you know, restrict. I think where it gets in, and Chris, not to hijack and turn this into – this episode, because I don't want to do that. But it's really hard to tell a guy who feeds his family.
I agree.
You know, not to do it. And I think really that's where things get really sticky. But I know guides are so against it. So
just because of the pressure it puts on the fish, that's the main
thing. I know guys on Lake St. Clair that are super against it.
Which
like
makes
a guy like Mike Hulbert. Right? I don't know Mike Hulbert, but because Chris and I have been kicking around this topic, his name comes up time and time again as a guy who's firmly opposed to it. This is a guy who makes his money. I don't know if he has a family or not, but I'm sure he feeds himself. And he wants to be successful like everybody else. And he's against it. And the guy, from what I understand, he slays. So I don't know, man. You're right. Everybody's right.
It's because it's like if you look at the progression of or the kind of advancement of technology in fishing, this is one of those game changer moments, right? It's like in hockey, the generational player that comes once every decade or something. Like, it's not just a new sonar or side scan. This is like something completely different, and it's almost turned fishing into hunting. You know, it's got that feeling like you're actually just hunting the fish through the live scope as opposed to fishing for it. So there's all sorts of, you know, obviously pros and cons against it, but we all know the history of how this technology merging with fishing and hunting works. I mean, we're never going to win the battle. Like, they're just going to get more advanced and more advanced and more advanced. And before you know it, you'll be picking up live scope for a couple $100 on your boat. You know,
oh, yeah.
It'll just be like, you know, part of the, yeah.
Well, I think the underlying concern is the impact on the fishery. And
sure,
here we are sitting. We're sitting in a body of water, Chris, that was amazing to us 3-4 years ago and is being extremely cruel to us the last 2 years, because there's been no question that this fishery has been diminished. There's no question.
Is that a function of that, or just like the diseases and the different parasites or some of the things that have been affecting the musky community?
Oh, Chris, yeah. I'm sure it's all of that. Using something like a live scope is only going to contribute to the downside of that, mm-hmm. right? It's only going to cut down. Maybe not a huge deal on Lake St. Clair.
Yeah, we don't have a stocking program. That makes a big difference. Putting hooks in natural fish will make the natural fish stop biting.
Exactly. So, you know what? It's, again, that's exactly why this is a tough issue. And sure. You know what? In a future episode, we're going to talk about it.
Sure.
The Ugly Pike Podcast.
Do you know the name of Canada's one and only specialized pike and muskie shop? It's Izoco, and it's an Esox angler's paradise, offering the very best in hand-picked, top-quality gear, from bait casting to fly fishing, and even specialized Scandinavian tackle. Izoco's staff will provide expert advice and top quality service. But Izoco is more than just a store. It's a community of passionate anglers that make up the Izoco tribe, and they're always ready to share tips, swap stories. So head over to their shop in person or online at izocofishing.com and let Izoco turn those fishing trips into epic stories.
How did a small-town sheet metal mechanic come to build one of Canada's most iconic fishing lodges? I'm your host, Steve Nidzwicki, and you'll find out about that and a whole lot more on the Outdoor Journal Radio Network's newest podcast, Diaries of a Lodge Owner. But this podcast will be more than that. Every week on Diaries of a Lodge Owner, I'm going to introduce you to a ton of great people, share their stories of our trials, tribulations and inspirations, learn and have plenty of laughs along the way.
Meanwhile, we're sitting there bobbing along trying to figure out how to catch a bass, and we both decided one day we were going to be on television doing a fishing show.
My hands get sore a little bit when I'm reeling in all those bass in the summertime, but that's might be for more fishing than it was punching.
You so confidently you said, "Hey Pat, have you ever eaten a drum?"
Find Diaries of a Lodge Owner now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
I was going to ask about the unconventional tactic of casting in the shallows, actually, during this time of year, and you touched on it. And And I mean, I think people need to know that they can have success doing that and not having to just go into a colder time or a late fall or mid to late fall period and just only think about trolling, right? We've talked to people and I wanted to get your perspective on that. If something you ever do is casting those shallow areas and what are your thoughts on that? But we kind of touched on it, but I think people need to know that's an option for them, you know, that typically you don't think of when you're fishing at this time.
My experience level casting in November is very, very limited. I've always been a troller. And that dates back to when I was learning and I figured let's learn trolling first. Let's maybe learn casting after starting November. And back then it was painful to cast in November. So I don't have much to teach that I'm confident in. But that being said, the last time I was in a boat casting in November, my buddy hooked a 40-pound fish while my other buddy had a hook in his hand. And we weighed that fish on the scale. So casting in cold weather works, right? It was a 52 by 20 something weight on the scale and was just over 40 pounds. Yeah. Casting a Medusa.
I think, Frank, that's a question we can present to John at some point, maybe in early December, if we can get him on and discuss about, am I right? He only casts.
Yeah.
Mostly cast, yeah. Mostly.
Yeah, they're big time casters right to the bitter end. We can ask him in December. It probably won't air until January because we've got a pretty impressive backlog right now. Plus, we're going to get Hans in there. But we can certainly slide John in. John's overdue. John was supposed to be on this trip with us.
Yeah.
No offense, Attila. we slid Attila in because we love fishing with him. But John couldn't make it, and we were going to sit down with him. But John's always ready, especially when the season's done.
Nice.
I'm sure he's going to take off somewhere warm, but I can put that together anytime. I think we should. I mean, we haven't had John on since the 100th episode when we almost killed him with COVID. And yeah, we all got COVID that show. So if the listeners are listening to episode 100.
I remember that.
Oh, yeah. That was something else. Did we get skunked that year too? We got skunked that year.
Yeah. That's why we've had three rough trips in a row now.
That was one of them. That was really rough because not only did we get skunked, but we all got COVID-19.
Yeah.
That was fun. We had a very lively chat in the truck on the way back this morning from our adventures to get groceries about the fight and the boxing match that happened. I know we talked about it on the last Full Moon Friday episode, but I don't know if you want to get into that. We have the luxury of having Attila here who, you know, probably could have been a pro boxer if he wanted to, super good boxer. So I know, Chris, you're super interested in it as well. So if you want to open that can of worms, we can. We don't have to.
Why not? Why not? I like hearing that type of perspective about somebody who was near a pro athlete. So, you know, pro boxer. So, I mean, what do you want to say about the fight? Like Attila, Alex, what's your opinion on that fight? I mean, did you watch it? Were you glued to it or you just caught highlights or what's your position?
I work every weekend. So
you didn't see it?
I saw the highlights. Because I was obviously interested, I wanted to see it, and I was kind of surprised that he got knocked down, and obviously the decision was a decision that's been poisoning boxing for decades, and this is what it is. That's why.
So elaborate on that, though.
Obviously, Tyson Fury won by decision, but a lot of people think that Ngannou should have won the fight. And boxing has been so corrupt for years and years and years. That's why a lot of people hate boxing. And then when MMA came along, that's why a lot of people fell in love with MMA because that was just so real. And
it wasn't tainted yet, right?
That's right, exactly.
Well, I think we're starting to see it a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. And then, you know, Dana White always said, don't leave it in the hand of the judges, you know. So that's you can't say anything better than that. if you want to win, you got to go out there and put your heart and soul out and try to, you know, finish the fight if you can, without sacrificing your game plan. But Ngannou did a great performance, and I think Tyson Fury underestimated him. You know, I don't think he understood his power. And if you see the footage after his first knockdown, Tyson Fury's face was look on his face was like, holy crap, what was that?
And I just got clubbed.
Yes.
Talk.
So, and then the other thing, what I'm seeing is like, you know, now everybody's going to be probably pooping on boxing a little bit. Oh, boxing is a joke, blah, 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 this and that. I have to disagree on it a little bit. And if you look at back in history, every big champion had that one boogeyman in their life that was, you know, he beat everybody but that one guy he never could, you know, beat. And maybe Ngannou was the guy for Tyson Fury. It's only time will tell if Ngannou is going to keep on the path of professional boxing, which I think he should. You know, he's going to be tested again and again. And if he's doing really, really well, then maybe it's not the case. Maybe he's not just a boogeyman. Maybe he's a really a true champion, right?
But what do you think are some classic boogeymans in boxing history?
Because
you said that in the car, I was like, you know what? That was really a really insightful comment. That's true. Like,
good question. I think
we know with Mike Tyson, it was Evander Holyfield.
Yeah.
Maybe that's
yeah.
Maybe it was a different Tyson, so you can't quite say.
But I have to disagree with that. I mean, yeah, because Tyson it was after the jail, right?
After jail, Tyson was a
his prime. Yeah, he was in jail in his prime.
Yeah,
wouldn't Fury be Wilder's Deontay Wilder's boogeyman?
Is Deontay Wilder good enough and established enough to assign him a boogeyman?
I think so.
He was like 28 and 0 or something with 27 knockouts when he
fought. But
if somebody's like one of the greatest of all times, and that's the way people talk about Fury, I'm not sure you could say he's anyone's boogeyman. He's just really good.
Another thing, a lot of people say Tyson is one of the best ever. I would say Tyson Fury. I don't think he's one of the best ever. He's a really good heavyweight. I don't think he should be mentioned as the best ever. That's my humble opinion. But when we're talking about boogeyman, I'm not just want to talk about the heavyweights. A perfect example with the boogeyman is Bernard Hopkins and German Taylor. Like,
Hopkins not beat him? Hopkins could beat anybody.
Yeah, but Hopkins was so good. But then German Taylor beat him twice, I think, even three times. And so that, I think, that was Hopkins' boogeyman, and was another fighters out there that I can't remember now. But it's if you just look at back in boxing, look at the guy who was undefeated for the longest time. But that one guy, actually, Roy Jones Jr. Roy Jones Jr. lost against what was his guy name? Oh, I can't remember. He did fight him like two times for sure, and he lost. And. Like, so a boogeyman is a person that he beats an undefeated world champion, but then after that particular person is not really have a great career.
You mean like Frank Serra on GSP type guy?
Yes, exactly.
In any combat sports, there will always be technical mismatches.
That's right.
That
style
allow
makes fights.
An underdog to, yeah, yeah. There's technical mismatches.
But then again, what you said, Matt Serra and GSP. No, actually, I have to disagree with that because GSP beat him really easily after that. So I think GSP.
Matt Serra, he had that moment where he shocked the world, but then he never really was able to stay at that level and was
easy. That's right. But the boogeyman is a guy who has multiple fights with the same world champion and he beats him. Pretty much all the time or more times than how much times that's a boogeyman, right? So that one style for that one particular fighter is just doesn't work. He can't figure it out. And if you look at GSP and Metzler, that wasn't the case because GSP beat him really easily in the second fight. But so if Ngannou and Tyson Fury would fight again, if Ngannou beats him again, well, then he's the boogeyman. If Tyson Fury is going to avenge it, maybe he's not.
He's not going to go anywhere near him.
Yeah,
I don't ever again.
Tyson Fury, maybe he's going to retire after this. Who knows?
Oh, he's going to fight that other guy.
And he's another tough, tough, very, very technical fighter. He's, I think, it's
so small, though.
He is small, but the thing is, his footwork and he's like Lomachenko, but in heavyweight. You know, nobody can touch that guy. You know, he's just that good. And when you're able to move that like, look at that. Evander Holyfield was not true heavyweight either. He was a cruiserweight, right? And then he just built himself up. But you know, that's when someone that good that go up there and able to stand with those guys.
I speaking of styles made fights. The only fight I ever bet on was Ronda Rousey versus Holly Holm.
That was when
Ronda was killing everybody in 10 seconds.
Yeah, but
and again, my buddy calls me, Chris Rico called me,
yeah,
and he's like, what do you think about the fight? And I said, Ronda's going to lose. And he's like, you're crazy. And I'm like, it was 10-1 odds. And I said, put money on Holly Holm. And he put money on, you've never seen a guy, Chris, worth $50 million. So happy to win a couple thousand dollars in life. The guy, it was like his life got turned around. He was so happy, but we both made a good return on that because I put my money down and styles make fights. I knew that she was a good range fighter.
Styles make fights, but unfortunately in that particular fight, the problem was with Ronda Rousey, he flushed her own style down the toilet and was under the impression she's a good striker. If she would have stick to her judo and she would have stick to her close distance and take Holly Holmes down, that fight would have been, I think, a total different fight than standing up against a world champion striking with zero striking background.
Or so it looked like she tried to go back. After she got hit 100 times, she tried to. But at that point, it was too late.
It was too late.
She was broken. Yeah,
it was too late.
But that fight, from the moment she started to the moment it was over, she did not look like she belonged in the ring with her. And you're probably right. She didn't have the right strategy, but who's the champion, the greatest of all time in the women's, what's her name?
Amanda Nunes?
Nunes. What she did to Rousey was just brutal. But Holm said, like, yeah, she owned that fight, and you're right. She had a completely different strategy that played totally against her skill set.
Because her trainer made her believe that she's a striker now, and when they start posting videos about her shadow boxing and hitting the pads,
my God, it was so bad.
It was so bad that she basically she got exposed, and everybody knew that she doesn't know anything about striking. So you know. And then now you go against with the world champion, and because Holly Holmes was a world champion kickboxer, I believe, and you know you're gonna be picked apart, and you're gonna be put away. So that's what happened.
I think too, not to dwell on women's MMA, but I think at that point, Ronda, by the time the Amanda fight came along, Ronda was just, I think Holly broke her.
Oh, I think so, right? Too.
And
yeah, yeah.
They say too, like when a fighter gets knocked out, your chin's not usually the same after that.
Depends on the person. I think it's really depending on the person. You know, obviously multiple full knockouts.
Did you ever get knocked out?
I've been knocked down. I've never been knocked
out. Did you ever knock anybody out?
Yeah.
Did you ever knock anybody out last week?
Not last week, but you know,
on the boat?
Definitely the stats went higher in the summertime. Definitely the stats went higher.
Jesus.
Yeah. But that's a different story. On the street is a different story, but in the ring is another different story. But.
And just so the listeners know, Attila doesn't go around picking fights with people on the street.
No, I work as a bouncer.
He works as a bouncer part time, and so you know what, it's a pretty rough bar, and sometimes people get out of control.
And he pass people down for knives, and people try to sneak knives by him by using their buddy system, and he needs to watch.
These days, unfortunately, you're gonna have to pay attention and do what you gotta do to keep everybody safe, keep yourself safe, right?
What kind of place is that where they're smuggling the knives? I'm not gonna bring my
every, like, you know, you would be surprised. Every place, like, everybody's wearing a knife you know, not everybody, but a lot of people carry knives these days. Yeah. And it's just, I always tell the guys, listen, if you have anything on you, just let me know. I'll take it. If you go back home, you know, I'll give it back to you. Anything nice about it, I'll do so. But if they're, you know, being rude or anything, then I'm not even going to let them in, or I'm not even going to give the knife back to them or something. But, you know, it's just, you shouldn't bring a knife into a bar. It's not the place.
There's no good reason.
Exactly. That's right. Absolutely. And I want everybody to be safe. I want to be safe. You know, I just want to go home to my family and that's that. And I want everybody to do the same, right? And, you know, we're not bullies. I'm not a bully. I'm 46 years old. You know, I do this for a long time, since 1996. You know, in my 20s, you know, obviously I was a lot more hothead than now. And you know, you want to prove yourself and stuff. But now I don't have to prove anything to anybody, not to myself, not to my friends, to my coworkers, to anybody. So, you know, we're not bullies. We try really to de-escalate the situation. Knocking people out is easy. De-escalating the situation and not having a fight is the more difficult part. And we try to do that. The knocking out part is really the last result when we have no choice. You know, we've been either throw a punch at, or we're being attacked, and then you can't avoid it. Now that's a self-defense, right?
That's Attila's diplomatic answer.
That's right. That's what we're telling the cops.
Right. Yeah. Wait, it's the first time this podcast has had two stab wound victims in it?
Yes, yes. You and well, I've been stabbed.
Frank posted a picture of us 2 years ago.
It was a video.
Video? Yeah, video. We're talking about our stabbing story.
You know what? We
both went stabbed?
Like two, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was stabbed in Hungary in two spots, and I was in hospital for 13 days.
Two spots? Yeah. You have like 10 fucking scars.
Yeah, because the doctors opened me up and they saved my life. So when I get stabbed in the chest and on my...
So you got stuck in an organ.
Luckily, it was only an inch by the heart, so I was pretty lucky to stay alive.
So they cut you open to stitch you up inside
That's right. Okay. They opened my chest, so they had to open my chest to make sure everything is okay inside.
Chris, maybe the cover art for part two should be a close-up of Till's torso.
52 stitches later, you know.
I'm sure Izoka would appreciate that.
13 days in the hospital, but, you know.
13 days in the hospital. What about you, Alex? Did you go to the hospital for 13 days?
No, it was just one night, and it was 17 stitches because they missed – it was in the chest and between the ribs, and they missed my lungs completely.
This was all over musky spots, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Right in the launch.
This is what happens.
You want to watch out because Attila and I are very high strung in the launch. Where we got eyes all around our head. We're always standing with our back to the boat. It's terrible.
Thank God you guys made it.
We're going to try to stay out of trouble this afternoon. So the only trouble might be this wind. It's picked up.
Yeah, the wind's nasty. We're not casting.
I'm a lover, not a fighter.
There you go. All right, Chris. Anything else?
Get on the water now.
We have a quick bite to eat. And then we're going to jump out and stay on the water. So probably around 7 or 8 o'clock tonight. And then come in and have a homemade pasta dinner. We got sauce from my mother-in-law, meatballs from my mother-in-law, and handmade pasta from Niagara Pasta Co. Sick. My buddy Dan Walker. And you know what? It's going to be an epic fishing meal tonight. So fuel us up for the last day, get some carbs in there. Yeah. And
if you want to have some good homemade pasta, that's the guy.
Look
him up.
Yeah. So it's going to be a good couple of days. We just got to take care of the fish part. And
well, you got one down. Just two more to go, and then you guys are all going to be happy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, Chris. Anything else before we say goodbye? Leave us a review, guys, if you wouldn't mind. I know, Chris, you always remind me of that, but head over to iTunes or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Please leave a review for us. It really helps. Chris, what else before we say
Alex, where can people buy Barbarian Braid?
Conveniently, at Izoko. I was going to tell you guys, good job with that. And they can also get it at Angling Sports in London.
Yeah, we haven't announced that partnership yet, but we will soon.
And your rods, so are those on the horizon?
The rods will be available at rods will be available at the Odyssey. I think some retailers are already interested, but I haven't even gotten that far ahead yet. But yeah, you guys are in good hands with Izoco and Angling Sports. Very, very pleasant retailers to deal with on my end. Very pleasant retailers to deal with on my end. And you guys can get braid on barbarianbraid.com too, or just reach out to me directly. But if you're near those retailers, walk in. It's worth it.
Nice. Yeah, we're really happy. So things are going well. All right. Thanks very much for that. And Frank, I think he left. Is he there? Oh, he's back.
I'm right here.
So Frank,
I just went to throw some hot dogs in and
sign off till the next time. And good luck to you guys. Hopefully more success on your trip and safe travels on the boat. And we'll talk soon.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.
All right, you guys. Thanks for listening. Till next time.
The Ugly Pike Podcast.
What do football, hockey players, boxers, and fishing guys have in common?
A love for the outdoors.
I'm Jamie Pastilli, a fishing guide with a lifetime of experience chasing down some of North America's most sought-after species with some of the world's most interesting characters. On Outdoor Journal Radio's Tackle Box podcast, I'm joined by one of those people, CFL legend Brad Sinopoli, as we share stories and talk to the athletes who found their passion through hunting and fishing.
World heavyweight champion Tyson Fury, they brought you in to spar this big animal.
I had a rod, so I just randomly brought it to Colorado and got me hooked up on some beautiful fish in those big rivers. And it was some of my best memories of during my hockey career.
So join Jamie and I every week on the Tackle Box for a behind-the-scenes look at some of your favorite athletes and angling personalities.
From hits to tangles, passes into angles, the Tackle Box has your sports and angling listening covered.
Find the Tackle Box now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
Do you know the name of Canada's one and only specialized pike and muskie shop? It's Izoco, and it's an Esox angler's paradise, offering the very best in hand-picked, top-quality gear, from bait casting to fly fishing, and even specialized Scandinavian tackle. Izoco's staff will provide expert advice and top-quality service. But Izoco is more than just a store. It's a community of passionate anglers that make up the Izoco tribe, and they're always ready to share tips, swap stories. So head over to their shop in person or online at izocofishing.com and let Izoco turn those fishing trips into epic stories.